Hi folks, welcome to the Money 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 podcast. I'm Surabhi Upadhyay and we come to you every week with some very interesting conversations to help you get your personal finances in order and get smart with your money. Budget 2020 is behind us, but the queries aren't. This budget has been perhaps slightly more taxing for the super rich. They did go in with several wishes, not too many of them were answered, and there are certain measures that come out in the fine print that perhaps could make life a little more tough, a little more challenging. We're going to be discussing the impact of Budget 2020 on the rich. My guests on the show are Anshu Kapoor, head of Edelweiss Private Wealth Management, as well as Girish Vanwari, founder of Transaction Square. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining in. It's been that kind of a budget that the conversations are just about winding to a close. And we haven't even seen the full Finance Act just yet. But, you know, Anshu, I want to know whether your phones have been ringing ever since, because there have been lots of issues, whether it was, you know, this TCS on the LRS, your, you know, onward remittances, the fact that the super rich surcharge was not withdrawn. What is the feedback your savvy clients have been giving you?
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, Surabhi. It's always great to be here. Well, I must say our clients actually, because many of them do run businesses, are business entrepreneurs and so on, they found it a balanced budget overall. And obviously, there were expectations on the taxation side largely. But I think most clients understand, given the fiscal situation and the way it was explained by the finance minister, that not much could have been expected from a tax relief perspective. So I think that was there. There are a few amendments or modifications, like you mentioned, to the remittance scheme or to trust and so forth. But I think they are all not going to impact too much as far as their life is concerned.
So there's not too much heartburn, you're saying?
Not really, not really. From an investment standpoint, from their business standpoint, actually a lot of relief came because, as I said, they run businesses. So a lot of relief came earlier,
in September. In the corporate
yes,
tax cut.
Yes, last year. Okay. So that gave a lot of relief from a business standpoint.
Sure.
From a personal standpoint, obviously every budget has some minor things here and there. So there is an impact and our clients are studying the impact. Yes, they have been asking us. There are a lot of questions around, you know, how, because, you know, you understand, holding entities are in trust in corporate structures or LLPs or personal. So now maybe you have to relook at everything and say, okay, how do I deal with my investments?
Sure. Well, which is exactly why we have the two of you here, and Girish here specifically, because he has his expertise in these matters. Now, Girish, one of the immediate, you know, calculations or takeaways that I heard right after the, you know, announcements was that this is going to get difficult because dividends are now being taxed in the hands of the individual. First, it was this flat, 10% tax that your mutual fund would levy. And now those who are earning more and are in the higher tax brackets, they stand to get adversely impacted. So are people already looking for alternate structures?
No, absolutely. I think it's important to understand what happened. So first of all, dividend distribution tax was abolished. That was a popular ask. The people were also expecting that the dividend taxation rate in the hands of the recipient would remain the same. Presently, it is 10%. And they were hoping that 10% would continue and dividend distribution tax would get abolished. That 10% continuance has not happened.
No, it's 10% for mutual funds, but at the company level, originally it was 20%, right?
Yeah, actually the company pays 20% and the recipient, which is us, we pay 10% today. This 10% now is taxed at the regular rate of income. So if you're a company, you have to pay 25%. If you're an individual, it could go as high as 43%, so on and so forth. Who does it benefit? It benefits if you're a non-resident. If you're a non-resident, then depending upon the treaty you fall with, you can get up to 5 or 15%. And most investments are through Mauritius, Singapore, Netherlands, UK, US. All of them would benefit from this. But certainly Indians will lose out from this. And the biggest hit will be Indians which are owning shares in their own name, which are founders of companies and people who've transitioned into trusts, because trusts also is like an individual.
Yes.
So I just go back to the trust structure. I mean, when trust was formed, there were several reasons. Inheritance tax, succession planning, asset protection, and so on and so forth. And one reason was tax too. Previously, if you look at 3 years back, trust did not pay tax on dividends which it got.
Okay.
Individuals paid.
Okay.
Then trust got covered in the ambit. So now it is 10 plus surcharge, which is respectively 14%. And now it's become 43%. Hmm. So the trust has become like an individual. So there is no savings of holding shares through a trust. So people who have run and, you know, transitioned shareholding from companies, LLPs to trusts, now are thinking that was that the right thing to do?
So, you know, this whole trust issue, you know, the trust of the trust started, I think, you know, with the previous budget.
Absolutely.
When the surcharges were introduced, and the government made it very clear that they don't fancy the trust structure.
Correct.
Because they, in their opinion, it's opaque, and why Correct. Is there a need to, you know, form a trust? Now, on the subject of dividends, what's the sort of best course of action now? Because I don't know if there's going to be a rethink on this.
So I think, you know, first of all, there has to be a parity. Mm-hmm. There has to be a parity between a non-resident investor and a resident investor. Mm-hmm. A non-resident investor has to pay maximum 20% tax mm-hmm. for dividends. Mm-hmm. Forget the treaty. Treaty will only get it down to maybe 5% also. Mm-hmm. So there is no parity for an individual promoter or an individual like you and me to pay 43% tax on the dividends. Mm-hmm. So that parity would demand that the representations which are being made, 43 should come down to 20 at least. Mm-hmm. Or even 10 to really get the capital formation by investment in stock market happening. Don't forget LIC IPO is coming. So all those, if divestment is a big agenda, then Indians are also big investors in the stock market. So this parity is very, very important.
I take your point. I mean, there's 43% and then there is 20%,
Correct.
Which is the maximum that a foreign investor
Correct.
Has to pay. Or, you know, an Indian which is residing overseas will have to pay. Now, Anshu, on the question of dividends and the manner in which this new dividend tax is going to be sort of levied, what are the conversations that your clients are having with you, and is this a real big issue for them as well?
Well, like Girish mentioned, first of all, wherever there are promoters holding shares or there's significant shareholding in companies and dividends were a form of significant chunk of their cash flow or income, obviously there's an impact. So that's a little bit unpleasant impact that clients are seeing. But as far as the investment portfolios are concerned, obviously now clients are saying, should we move from dividend plans to growth plans?
Right.
And so it's those small things are starting to take place now, and that execution will happen once the document is crystallized.
Okay.
And obviously, it'll be great to see some representation and great to see if some changes happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this has been absorbed in the system largely
by
most clients that, you know, this is the new law and this is the change.
Okay.
If something changes, great. But I think it's got absorbed as we speak.
I want to sort of take off from this issue of, you know, the trust structure and ask you gentlemen what happens to REITs and InVITs. Because, Anshu, if I go back to a conversation we had just a, you know, couple of months back, you were telling me that the HNI is very happy putting his money in REITs, if not in physical real estate. Is that trend A still intact? And would this investment be at risk now?
Absolutely. First of all, let me tell you, annuity creating assets where you can create a fixed income annuity. That is something that is really, really in great demand. And if you see the recent reports, about 20,000 crores of fresh InVIT issuances are expected in the country in this financial year. So it's going to be a big asset class. And there's a lot of foreign money coming in. And there's a lot of ultra high net worth money going into these asset classes. And it's all led by what is happening in the fixed income markets in India, as in the yields are falling off. So it continues to be a great investment option. And as far as these taxation implications are concerned, our expectations are that in the fine print, in the final budget document, it'll all get cleared out, because conceptually, I don't think as a trust structure, so to speak, it should attract that kind of taxation. Obviously, Girish can elaborate on that, but we feel that still it continues to be a great opportunity.
Provided there's no major change in tax.
Absolutely.
So Girish, what is the present taxation structure? How much tax does a REIT investor have to pay? And what's your interpretation of the Finance Bill 2020?
See, clearly, for the dividend distribution by the REIT or InVIT, now there's a taxation. So that makes REIT and InVIT quite inefficient, because the arbitrage of taxation was very important for the yield of the REIT and InVIT. But we've been having chats with several institutions and bodies, and there's a big demand that they should go away. And
so just to jog memory, what was the current taxation structure?
Present, it is a pass-through.
Okay.
And that is now being replaced by a withholding and then a taxation at a maximum marginal rate.
Of 43%, because if the trust, if it's treated like an individual, then it falls into that bracket.
Absolutely. So that is something which is a very big worry, and that will make REIT and InvIT very unviable actually as a product for HNIs. Maybe yes, global investors will invest because of treaty concessions which they'll get. But HNI will not find it attractive.
Now on the subject of real estate, at least there's some good news, right? Because earlier I think if you were doing a transaction at less than circle rate, even if the market price was lower, you'd only have the 5% flexibility in the circle rate and the level at which this transaction could have happened. Now that's been extended to 10%. Is that good enough relief?
Absolutely not. So what is happening today, the stock market is up, real estate is very down. The circle rates are still very high. The difference between the circle rate and the real value is around 20-25%. That's what I hear in the marketplace. So people are finding it difficult to transact. Now if you look at, say, HNIs, they are deleveraging their individual assets to actually repay the loan or depledge their shares and so on and so forth. So a lot of people are finding it difficult to do deals because the rates in the registrars are far higher than the real price, which leads to taxation.
So how does that impact the tax liability?
The way it happens is like when you suppose if an asset is 100 rupees and the rate in the registrar is 120, if I transact at 100, I have to still pay tax on 120. And for the recipient, if you buy it for me, you have to pay tax on 20 as income because you're getting an asset cheap. So it makes the transaction very unviable. So 10% is a good progress over 5. But should that be 20, 25? Certainly it should be higher.
So well, those are some of the points on real estate. Anshu, as an asset class, do you see any interest? I mean, we're also winding up this whole year. Physical real estate has been a big no-no. What do you see on physical real estate in the months to come?
Well, as far as the ultra high net worth investors are concerned, they are already holding a lot of investments into real estate. These could be in the form of land, it could be in the form of residential apartments, and now increasingly commercial real estate. But also there is an interest to now hold in a financial form, as in through funds or through REITs. So as far as this tax implication is concerned, I do not think it's going to make too much of a difference because anyways the interest to hold physical real estate is fairly low. And yes, they may want to exit when the prices are there. So as far as the interest is concerned, commercial, it's a very big asset class, but increasingly the preference is to hold it through financial instruments like funds or REITs. So they could become very large investment vehicles.
So that's all about real estate. And now we come to the hottest point, perhaps, of the budget, which is this whole NRI tax or catch the NRI sort of, bandwagon, right? Girish, there was some clarifications just post the budget. But I don't know if that's any sort of a rollback, because now they're saying that if you spend more than 120 days in the country, then you will have to pay tax in India?
So actually, there are two, three dimensions of it. Clarification has come only for one dimension. One dimension is a stateless citizen, a person who is a vagabond, who's a, you know, who doesn't live anywhere, 40 days here, 50 days there, 60 days there. And he's a citizen of India, is a tax resident nowhere, pays tax nowhere, doesn't pay tax in India on the full worldwide income. So the law says that this person will be taxed in India. Then the debate comes like, okay, if a guy is staying in Dubai there is no taxation. But you can still be a tax resident of Dubai. Because under the India-UAE treaty, if you stay 182 days in Dubai and if you have a house, you have nexus, there are tests to be mentioned. And if you're a resident of Dubai, then you're entitled to the treaty benefit. You become a tax resident of Dubai and then you don't have to pay tax in India because you're not a stateless citizen. That's the clarification which came. That if you're a proper resident somewhere else and you're earning your income there, you know, living there, even if there is no tax there, doesn't matter. You don't have to pay tax on that
income. But you will have to comply now with the 120-day rule.
That is a worry.
Instead of 180.
That is a worry. That's
so
a second dimension.
More time in India.
Yeah, that's a second dimension. People who want to come to India for doing business or being with their parents or for any other reason, they are citizens of India. They have to now be in India for maximum 120 days. And that change is expected. That change is required. That's feared people away.
Okay, Anshu, on this, you know, because the allegation was that because the super rich tax, you know, became as onerous as 43%, people were looking at this smart engineering to perhaps, you know, avoid paying tax or part of the tax here in India. So, you know, what would you say? What's the feedback that you've picked up in the circles?
I mean, obviously, there's no data behind all these things. And it's very hard to say. But what we have seen is it's not a big impact on our clients. They are still assessing it wherever there are NRIs or they are genuinely, you know, their business operations and parts of the family are overseas. And they will have to make these tweaks now. They will have to make these tweaks and adjust to the new 120-day kind of a scenario. Mm-hmm. So as far as that part is concerned, there is not much of a problem. Mm-hmm. They are just waiting for the fine print to come as to how these things will work. Mm-hmm. So in our client segment, it doesn't really impact them. Okay. The only this additional 60 days that they need to accommodate for is what they will have to plan for. It really doesn't matter too much.
Girish, the point on this TCS on remittances, and I know because Anshu would have been advising a lot of his clients to invest in overseas markets because they're getting better returns. So now how is this going to work? It's not an additional tax, but it's something by which the government wants to keep a tab on all money above 7 lakhs going out?
Absolutely. All money above 7 lakhs going out, 5% of that, mm-hmm. and that has to be collected and paid to the government. Mm-hmm. Of course, the person who's remitting the money mm-hmm. gets a set off of that against his other income.
Okay.
But let me tell you the complications. Is the $250,000 limit inclusive of this 5%? Or is it mm-hmm. $250,000 plus $12,500?
Okay.
Remittance is only $250,000. So I presume that this is over and above the $250,000 which you're paying. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, what they did is that Anshul, me, brothers, he will send, his wife will send, his children will send, mm-hmm. and we'll do 8 people sending $250,000 each.
Sure.
So yes, I'm a earning member, so I will get a credit for this 5%. Mm-hmm. What about the rest? Some are juniors also in the family who mm-hmm. use the scheme. So mm-hmm. the credit mechanism, yes, mm-hmm. it is a good thing that we will get a credit and it's a track. Mm-hmm. Then some people may be able to get the credit, some people may not have income.
Right.
They may be getting money as gifts which are getting remitted under the LRS scheme. Okay. One more dimension to this. Is it on income? Is it on capital? Because you may actually spend $250,000 spending it out completely. Mm. Or you may be investing in some shares or buying a house. Mm-hmm. On that also you have to deduct 5%. Answer is yes, it is on both. It's on all remittances. And
any money going out above 7 lakhs?
Correct.
5% TCS?
Correct.
Okay. So Anshu, I don't know, I mean, it's still early days. But is it going to weigh on, the advisory of overseas investment, whether you're looking at, real estate overseas or even equity overseas?
It will. Okay. Because a family of four sending $1 million. Mm-hmm. And as you know, even minors could send mm-hmm. that money overseas. So it does impact to that level. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we need to see the fine print again as to see how this will work and on what all categories this applies to. Mm-hmm. But it does impact because on $1 million, if you have to keep aside 5%, which is $50,000, that is a big chunk of money, and then the whole process of getting it back and so forth. Mm-hmm. But what
it's a lot of disclosure.
Yeah, correct.
That
I think disclosure is fine, but it's just the procedural hassles and when it comes back, keeping a tab on that and all those mm-hmm. things. And also, it's an additional cost to you mm-hmm. when you're making that investment.
Mm.
And in that sense, it dilutes your returns also.
Mm, that's true.
But what may happen is there are now a lot of feeders from India are available.
Mm.
These are rupee feeders into overseas funds.
Okay.
So you could buy ETF overseas, mm-hmm. but feed through a mutual fund structure.
So there's no need for LRS. You simply invest in rupees.
So you could invest in rupees and therefore mm-hmm. there is no TCS applicability. Mm-hmm. So again, if you want to diversify internationally, you will not have all the options, but you will have some of the options available.
Mm.
But obviously, it does affect all other forms of remittances.
Sure.
As in, for studies or any other purposes, if you mm-hmm. send money overseas, mm-hmm. it does impact that. From an investment standpoint, it limits your ability to mm-hmm. access global markets
mm-hmm.
As long as, you are hurt by that 5%.
Okay. So, there are restrictions and there are rules and there is more fine print that we need to go over. Gentlemen, we're coming to the end of this conversation. So, let me ask you, Anshu, with all of these, new regulations in place, as this year winds down, what is your advice to the rich or the super rich in terms of how they should deal with their money?
I think our number one advice is to carefully look at your fixed income portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where a lot of movement is happening in the markets. Mm-hmm. Given RBI has been very creative and very intelligent about trying to bring down, and they're having an impact mm-hmm. on bringing down the yields.
Mm-hmm.
So the yields in the markets are going down gradually,
mm-hmm.
which exposes the fixed income portfolio significantly.
Mm-hmm.
If you have cash flows coming in, or if you have monies that are being redeemed or coming up for reinvestment, that you need to very carefully lock in.
Okay.
And you need to also evaluate what new options are available or how you shuffle your investments.
Mm.
For example, good old tax-free becomes very, very interesting.
Okay.
It's still 5.6%, pre-tax 10%. And
which is the instrument that you're...
The tax-free bonds.
The tax-free bonds.
That are available in the markets. You can buy at a yield of about 5.6% today. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a pre-tax of about 10%. Mm. And it doesn't inflate your taxable income.
Okay.
So, a very, very good opportunity. Market-linked debentures, you know, tax efficient, but also give you access. Mm. There is a spread difference between AA and AAA. These are, you know, the nuances of the fixed income markets right now. Then we did discuss about annuity generating assets like REITs or InvITs. So this is the kind of opportunity set available to clients on fixed income.
Okay.
Commercial, real estate we talked about through REITs.
Equity is missing in this whole conversation. Are you expecting this to be a dull year for equity?
Equities, there's a shuffle bit from large cap to mid cap a little bit because of the valuation gaps that existed. So there's a little bit of a shuffle going on from large cap stocks to mid cap towards mid cap portfolios. That is where we see some value available.
Okay.
I think markets will take time because profitability is now Nifty profits for this quarter till now the results we've seen. 19% up, but revenue growth is almost zero.
The animal spirits are missing, I guess.
So, unless until those, but there are green shoots. The PMI composite, auto sales are kind of flattening out. You know, they still decline, but they're flattening out. The other parts of the country, you know, where we're seeing data flattening out. It is not growth, but it is not depression.
Hopefully it's the bottom. I think that's what we're saying.
So this whole intent of the RBI to push yields downwards is going to expose a lot of portfolios.
Okay.
And the return expectations are coming down.
So I got your point. I think that's going to be the one clear takeaway. Watch out for the way yields move. That's going to be the determining factor over the next couple of weeks. Now, Girish, last word with you. For all those who are kind of confused post the budget, as we roll into a new year, what is the advice that you would give purely in terms of tax planning, structures, the way the rich are looking at their money?
I would say substance over form, clearly. Okay. So it's not do away with the trust or do a trust or abolish this or abolish that. Wait, pause, put substance over form, have a business rationale, then do things.
Okay, all right. So no shortcuts, perhaps.
No shortcuts at all.
All right, gentlemen, great conversation. Thank you very much for joining in and clarifying some of these issues that impact the HNI. That's it on this week's podcast. You can catch the show at 6:30 p.m. on Tuesdays with repeats on Saturday and Sunday mornings only on CNBC TV 18. You can also find us on the CNBC TV 18 YouTube channel. Do send your feedback, comments, queries. Catch me on Twitter. My handle is at Surabhi Upadhyay. That's S-U-R-A-B-H-I-U-P-A-D-H-Y-A-Y. Don't forget to add the hashtag money. Catch you next week.